The Capital Connection is a production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio. David Gustina is the producer of The Capital Connection. Support comes from United University Professions, representing 37,000 academic and professional employees at SUNY campuses and teaching hospitals across New York State. Frederick E. Cole, President, UUPinfo.org.
It's the Capital Connection. Hi, I'm Alan Chartok. Joining us this week is Jesse McKinley, the Albany Bureau Chief of the New York Times. Welcome back, Jesse. We're honored to have you with us. Thanks for coming.
Thanks for having me, Alan.
Let's talk about the number one subject, the coronavirus. We've been listening to the governor all week long. He's gotten tremendous kudos from virtually everywhere, a sort of sense of humor, plus just telling the facts, as Jack Webb used to say, just the facts, ma'am. What's the impression in the press corps of his of how he's been doing?
Well, you know, it's kind of all hands on deck at this point. So there hasn't been a lot of consideration as to how the governor is doing. You know, I don't think we're actually going to know until, 3 months, 6 months, 9 months down the road. I think that he has received a lot of compliments for remaining calm. I think he has been press available. He's been out there almost every day. He's answered, numerous questions from not only the Albany press corps, but from the national press corps. And certainly as a reporter, that is something that we appreciate. I think in terms of the actions he's taken, they have been generally considered aggressive, but not draconian. And I think that to a large extent, he is winning plaudits from a lot of quarters for his approach to this. You know, he is now in his 10th year in office here in Albany. He certainly knows how Albany works, but I think he has been helped in this crisis by previous experience in the federal government, as well as just knowing how to handle crises. You know, he often mentions the fact that he used to be HUD secretary, that he had experience working on hurricanes and things like this. And even as governor, he has taken a great interest in kind of tackling kind of big, hairy public emergencies, whether they be, once again, hurricanes or you know, outbreaks of measles or X, Y, and Z. So I think this is kind of in his sweet spot. He knows and likes doing disaster coverage, and this is a heck of a disaster, to be sure.
It sure is. You know, my pal, the producer of this program, David Gustina, asked me an interesting question recently, which was, you know, he's run for 3 terms. Maybe he won't run for a 4th term. Maybe he'll take a major position in a Biden cabinet if Biden wins. You got any thoughts on that?
Well, I think we're still a long, long, long way away from November. I think, the coronavirus is one of the instructive lessons of this terrible disease is how quickly it has changed the politics, not only in the country, but in terms of the election. You know, I don't think a month ago anyone would have thought that Donald Trump would be as crippled by this disease and by the economic swoon as he has been. You know, we're now a lot of economic indicators right now seem to suggest we'll be going into a recession or something even worse. I don't think that was what people thought was going to happen this election cycle. I think there's going to be a lot of people unemployed. I don't think that's anything anyone expected this election cycle. So making predictions about what might be, 8 months down the road is kind of a fool's errand. Now, that being said, I think that, as I was saying before, the governor's generally good reviews for this has certainly heightened his national profile and certainly would make him, a appealing candidate for kind of a federal level position if a Democrat actually wins in November.
And one can only speculate, since he was the HUD secretary, he's not going to do that again, what it would be. And it seems to me that, you know, some of the major positions might be, this is, of course, smoke, we know that, but, you know, Attorney General of the United States.
Well, he certainly has a legal license. He has passed the bar. He's Attorney General of the state of New York, so he certainly knows the law. That is a job that he could well be qualified for. You know, other people, just kind of idle speculation, would say, you know, he could do something like Homeland Security. But once again, I think that's so far away. I think there are going to be so many twists and turns, you know, even in the next week, let alone the next 8 months, before we actually get to an election.
So let's go back to the coronavirus, which is what everybody's talking about. So let me ask you this. You know, New York has now become sort of an epicenter. It didn't start that way. Washington State was, but now New York is. And with it come tremendous ramifications. Can you sort of lay out some of them?
Well, I think they're kind of mind-boggling. I mean, the first and foremost is obviously the danger to people's health and the danger to people's lives. You know, we've got over 4,000 cases now in New York State. We've got, you know, over 700 people in hospital and in serious condition. And we have deaths. You know, we are up to 20 as of yesterday, and I think that number will continue to rise. All of that is tragic and terrible and heartrending for people that are going through it. And then, of course, there are economic ramifications. You know, the state was already kind of facing down a $6 billion deficit before this happened. The comptroller, Tom DiNapoli, said the other day that this is going to be at least a $4 billion hit. And I think that is just kind of back of the envelope calculations at this point. I don't think they have any idea how much money this may cost, not only in, you know, outlays of state resources in order to address the crisis, whether it be building out hospitals or building temporary hospitals or any number of things they may do, but also in terms of things like unemployment benefits, in terms of small business loans, in terms of supporting people that are losing their businesses, their livelihoods, and their paychecks as a result of this. So I don't think that anyone has any idea how much this is going to cost, and the governor has said as much. You know, he said earlier this week that this is not time to kind of monetize this, that this is the time to kind of address it as a public health crisis, which is what it is. So, you know, I think that there had been some hope that this would kind of blow through relatively quickly, that the weather would get warm, that the virus would die off, but indications from the governor's office and other medical health professionals is that this won't peak for another 45 days. And with every peak, of course, there will be a ramping down. And, you know, there's always fears that this could come back in the fall, a la the influenza. So, you know, I think we are going to be grappling with both the public health as well as the economic impact of this for months, if not years, to come.
Okay. So there is this relationship between the governor and the president that really defies description. On the one hand, we have the president continuing to trash the governor on tweets, but at the same time, the governor saying mainly nice things about the president, how they've gotten along, how the president is cooperating and sending a hospital ship and doing other things for New York. Can you put your well-known quill to this?
Well,
talk about mixing metaphors.
Know,
go ahead.
Yeah, no worries. You know, I think that by and large, the governor is trying to take the high road on this. The president is well known for being someone who likes to fling mud. And I think the governor is, by and large, trying not to, sink to his level. And also there is obviously a political and practical calculation going on here that the governor really needs federal help. You know, all the states need federal help. And New York, as, you know, the state with the most cases, really needs federal help. And so he can't really afford at this point to get into kind of a spat with Mr. Trump. And has been, as you pointed out, Alan, has been complimentary on several occasions. You know, when the Fed seemed to finally get their ducks in a row and ramp up testing, the governor said that was a good thing. He thanked the president the other day for sending this hospital ship, though, of course, it turns out the hospital ship is at least a month away. But still, you know, I guess it's the thought that counts. And the governor was complimentary to the president about doing that. But, you know, this is going to continue to evolve. I think that if the governor feels like New York is getting the short end of the stick, he will certainly be critical of the president. But at this point, he seems to be playing nice.
When the legislature figures into all of this, you watch Jesse McKinley of the New York Times, you watch the legislature and the governor. Has there been any evolution here? I mean, is Cuomo playing the predominant part in all of this? He keeps telling me when he talks to me that he doesn't have the ability to tell them what to do, basically. Is that true?
Well, I think the legislature certainly is much more independent now that they have, you know, kind of an all-Democratic majority in both houses. I think that they feel like they can help set the agenda. They can push back on what the governor wants sometimes. But once again, you know, this is a real crisis footing at this point. And I think that, you know, in talking to insiders here in Albany, there's a real sense that, like, a lot of the minor bickering that can go on during a budget cycle or during any legislative session is it's kind of diminished in this circumstance. You know, I think there is a real sense not only in the assembly where you have two members who have tested positive and have been sick, there's a real sense that they don't want to spend too much time in Albany, that they really want to get stuff done and get out of town and hunker down and try to ride out this contagion. And I think that sort of attitude is shared on the Senate side, and I think it's probably shared by the executive branch, too. I think they want to get stuff done. They don't want to fight. They've got other fights to take on, namely, you know, the coronavirus and the hardship of other people in the state. So, you know, the kind of normal back and forth and sniping and he said, she said, that goes on during a usual budget season, I'm not hearing a lot of that this year because I think everyone is trying to grapple with corona.
So, Jesse McKinley, tell us a little bit, because most New Yorkers have no idea who Speaker Hastie is and what kind of a political character he is. Can you give us a little insight?
Carl Hastie has been Speaker, I believe, now for 5 years, since Shelley Silver was unceremoniously dumped after he got indicted on federal corruption charges. He was convicted twice and is still waiting to go to prison, but leaving that aside, Carl Hastie has a different type of management style. I think Shelley Silver was well known for kind of having a heavy hand on most all things in the assembly. Carl Hastie is known much more as he likes to listen to people. He likes to hear everybody out. He generally is known for, like, letting almost every voice be heard. And then, you know, kind of taking that kind of consensus to negotiations. You know, some people fault him for that and say, well, he should be a little bit more authoritarian and, you know, like, really lay down the hammer. But by and large, I think his conference members, Democrats, appreciate the way that he hears them out. You know, he has been placed in a tight spot right now because of these two infections in his ranks. I think a lot of his members, or not a lot, but some of his members were understandably freaked out that they might have come into contact with the coronavirus. I think they're worried about not only their personal safety, but the safety of their staff and by extension, their constituents. So once again, he's grappling with that. He gave a press conference on Wednesday afternoon where he said that he had not been tested, but that he was encouraging anyone who felt like they needed to get tested to get tested. So once again, you know, this really is the year of the coronavirus in Albany and of course nationwide and globally. And it really does impact every interaction, including Carl Hastie's interaction with his own members.
And how about in the other house? We have a leader there, Andrea Stewart Cousins. How's she doing?
She has not yet had to confront a member with a positive diagnosis, but by the same token, you know, they are trying to strike a tone of continuing to do the people's business and continuing to be, you know, focused on, you know, the myriad issues that come up, whether it be bail reform or legalizing marijuana or you know, an Environmental Bond Act, while also grappling with, you know, real anxiety in their ranks about people coming to Albany, being in Albany, being in close quarters, taking votes in chambers. You know, on Wednesday, they both houses took votes, and they took them in very unusual ways, coming into the chamber either one at a time on the Senate side to kind of sign in and make their vote known, or on the Assembly side, they were called in kind of little batches of a dozen voters at a time to kind of come in and cast their ballots, so people weren't all kind of on top of each other as they normally are. So once again, everyone's adapting.
So we're not having major debates as a result of this, on debates for the television cameras and the kinds of things we've seen in the past?
Well, funnily enough, the assembly, which is known as the, how to put it, more loquacious of the two chambers, debates typically go on a lot longer in the assembly. There's a lot more members, and they have a lot more to say, usually. They actually did debate, but they debated in almost completely empty chambers, you know, just a couple of members scattered here and there, so people were socially distancing as they were doing their constitutional duty. But it was kind of a peculiar scene because, you know, there was almost no one else. They were talking basically to an empty room, so it was an odd one.
Jesse, I want to talk to you about the implications of the state budget. Now, under George Pataki, it was established that a governor had much more power than anybody ever thought, that he could include all kinds of, initiatives in the budget, and that he had the right to do that as a result of the budget. And so all of a sudden, governors began to put stuff in the budget. That's true for Andrew Cuomo, too, right?
100%. Those are known as Article 7 bills, and they are myriad. He has done all sorts of things through Article 7 bills, whether it be bail reform or all sorts of different policy issues have been shoved into the budget process. And that is a time-tested and very savvy move by any governor because, you know, the budget has to get passed. It's the one thing that really has to happen year after year. So if you put it in the budget, it can kind of force the legislature's hand.
And one of the things he'd like to put in that budget, he says, because, you know, on this one, I don't particularly trust him. He says that marijuana reform should be in the budget. What do you make of that?
This is the second year that legalizing marijuana has been on a short list of things that everyone says they want to do. Last year, of course, the fact that it was on a short list did not mean it got done. You know, it fell well short. They did a decrim bill instead. And this year, before coronavirus became the overwhelming theme of all things, marijuana legalization seemed to be gaining a little bit more momentum, seemed to be kind of, you know, mentioned by the governor, you know, perhaps, you know, even there was bill language out there. It seemed to be kind of maybe gaining some momentum, but, you know, I think it is unlikely that, considering the short amount of time before the budget is due, it's due on April 1st, which is less than 2 weeks from now, that they will be able to iron out what is a very complicated issue. You know, you're legalizing a drug that is still technically illegal in the eyes of the federal government. Other states have done this, of course, and the world hasn't burned. But, you know, I think that Cuomo has been cautious about this and has been recalcitrant on some level. But I can't imagine that this is really his priority right now. Now, having said that, I will contradict myself momentarily by saying that the one thing that I think marijuana legalization might have in its favor is the financial crisis. You know, this is potentially a big market that the state could earn some money off taxes and off licenses and stuff like that. So, you know, if it looks like the state is really going to come up short, maybe this will be presented as kind of an economic stimulus, and we shall see about that.
You know, you're Jesse McKinley of the New York Times, and I'm Alan Chartok, of far less stature, I may say. And maybe you can clarify something for me. I can see all the people who are for marijuana reform. Could you briefly tell me who's the major opposition to this?
Well, there's a group, I believe they're called SAM, Smart Approaches to Marijuana, that has been outspoken on this. I think that there are certainly people, and keep in mind that Governor Cuomo, as recently as, 2018, I think, had called marijuana a gateway drug. I think that there are people that are worried about legalized marijuana getting into the hands of youth whose brains are still developing, and this may not be a good drug for them to be trying or testing out. I think that there are law enforcement officials that are wary about having to suddenly police a whole new drug that has been legalized. You know, obviously something like alcohol causes a lot of problems, and I think they worry about adding marijuana to the mix. So there are people that are opposed to this. You know, this is not a universally loved idea. And I think that the governor has not necessarily been banging the drum on this. I don't think it is like his number one issue even before coronavirus. I think that to a large extent, he just felt it was inevitable, and other states in the region, including your Massachusetts, have done it and have made money off of it. So I think the governor was like very similar to the way he approached casinos, I think, a few years back. I think he was like, well, it's inevitable. We might as well just do it if everyone else is doing it. So I think that explains a little bit of his kind of cold feet about the issue. And once again, if it happens this year, I'll buy you a cup of coffee. How about that? I would be surprised.
I look forward to it. Okay, so now tell me about bail reform. Before we went to the virus, bail reform was really hot. There were many people who thought that people were going to get out of jail and commit a crime again because there was no bail. They weren't being kept there. Of course, we know what the other side was saying, which is it's always been an unfair system. True, I don't have any doubt about it, but it really seemed to have caught fire. I'm not hearing much now. What do you make of it?
Well, I think, once again, without, you know, repeating myself endlessly, I really do think that coronavirus is kind of sucking up all the oxygen in the room in terms of almost every issue right now. You know, you are absolutely right. In late December and early January, bail reform was as hot an issue as you could imagine in Albany. You know, people were really upset that some seeming or accused criminals were being released without being held on bail on kind of the more conservative end of the political spectrum. On the more liberal end of the spectrum, people were upset that, people that were simply accused of crimes were being held against their will simply by dint of not having enough money to make bail. There were passionate and logical arguments on both ends as to why bail reform was either a great idea or a terrible idea. And it had reached, you know, all the way to the top levels of state government. The federal government had started to chime in. It seemed like the attorney general had kind of bashed bail reform in New York. It was really kind of hitting, you know, a critical mass of both political and policy debate. And then coronavirus happened, and now it seems a lot less important, I think, in the eyes of a lot of legislatures, lawmakers, and policymakers. You know, it really has faded. Now, that being said, I think that when the budget emerges in the next couple of weeks from behind closed doors, where all these negotiations are going to have to happen because everyone is kind of social distancing, I think when that budget emerges, there probably will be some changes to bail reform. And I think that, you know, one view of that would be they will sneak in some changes to bail reform. Another view would be they're just going to put it out there and people will have to pay attention while they're not, you know, sitting at home while on, you know, kind of a stay-at-home order. So
some of those will probably
be changes for sure.
Well, some of those newly elected state senators who took over from Republicans were quite worried about it, that their constituents didn't like this. They were more conservative than the others. Do you think that the virus has taken some of the heat off of them on those issues?
I think 100% it's taken the heat off them. I think that the political landscape has been changed. I think that this issue of this virus and the state and federal and local reaction will probably dominate our national, local, and state dialogue for months to come. Now, keep in mind, maybe by the fall, you know, other issues will start to kind of once again percolate and once again become important. But right now, we're really in a national emergency, in a national crisis, and it really has it has dominated all sorts of discussions. You know, and rightfully or wrongfully, it has pushed other issues to the side. Now, maybe once we seem to get a handle on this, hopefully we will get a handle on this, those issues will once again become prominent. But right now, they are really on the sidelines.
Talk to me about some of the moves that Cuomo has made, which are really interesting. For example, New York has a real shortage of hand sanitizer, and now he's having 100,000 gallons made by prisoners in prison, and was criticized by several criminal justice reform groups for using prisoner labor. Did you cover that at the Times, and number one, and number two, what do you make of it?
Yes, we did cover it, and, you know, this is a situation where, you know, the governor thought that he was doing kind of a funny little rollout of this hand sanitizer thing. He was seemed very proud of it. He like put these big bottles of hand sanitizer behind a big curtain and did this, you know, this act of kind of unveiling them and ta-da, and here's all this hand sanitizer. And then, of course, people started to dig into where it was coming from, and it was coming from basically the Department of Corrections product service line, which is basically prisoners probably making 65 cents an hour or something like that, creating this stuff. And advocates rightfully pointed out that hand sanitizer, because it has a high alcohol content, is considered contraband. So the optics on this were not good for the governor because, you know, he was making a big deal of it. You know, he could have probably just done this, you know, quietly and no one would have, you know, really made a fuss over it. But the fact that he had made such a big deal of it, and then it turned out that the people that were actually making it couldn't even use it, and it is a, you know, it's a safety product at this point to kind of sanitize people's hands and keep them safe. The fact that the people that were making it who were not making any money basically to make it could not use it, all of that just didn't sit right with a lot of people.
You know, Jesse McKinley of the Times, we obviously had Abbott and Costello and all like that, but there's another team, which is Cuomo and de Blasio. These guys really don't seem to like each other, huh?
Cuomo and de Blasio, I don't think that they would be on a short list of besties, no. I think that they have known each other for a very long time. I think that, strangely, before all of this happened, it seemed like they had, you know, we're roughly on the same page on a lot of stuff. There hadn't been a real spat of late. And the Medicaid thing, where it looked like the state was trying to ding the city, had kind of once again flared up, and that looked so bad. But in recent days, and this has been kind of something that we've been trying to report out, they have not seen eye to eye on this idea of shelter in place, which, you know, you can go out and get groceries and you can go out for a jog and you can do kind of minor day-to-day things, but you should really stay at home to kind of prevent the spread of the virus. And Bill de Blasio said a couple of days ago that he thought this was probably a decent idea for New York and that they were considering it. And the governor said, no, I'm not going to quarantine people, blah, blah, blah. And, you know, the governor was kind of conflating quarantine and more extreme measures with shelter in place, which is basically a warning just to basically stay at home. So there have been signs during this crisis that they aren't playing well together and in unity. And when you see the governor and the mayor seemingly a little bit at odds or saying different things or saying different things could be happening, I think that that is unsettling for people.
We are out of time. Our guest has been Jesse McKinley, the Albany Bureau Chief of the New York Times. Jesse, thanks so much for joining us. We so appreciate it.
Yep. Stay safe, everybody.